You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Perhaps you remember growing up and there were two things that your mother told you you ought never speak of in public company. This is just something you should never do. What were they? The first was I heard religion. Politics and religion, yeah. Apparently, Peter didn't have a mother, and he speaks to both of these here tonight. Let's see this here. He says in chapter 2, verse 11, he says, "Dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers." So even as he begins to open up the subject and introduce it, he opens up by calling these believers aliens and strangers. Now, why does he do this? Well, namely for this reason. As Christians and the Christian worldview would dictate, we don't belong fundamentally to this world, but because we are going to go to heaven at some point and we're going to spend eternity there, our citizenship is in heaven, fundamentally speaking. The Bible teaches that this world in which we live is under the control, the power of the evil one, Satan. And it makes no apologies about that. It just boldly asserts that that's the case. And yet when we come to faith in Christ, we have become transferred out of the kingdom of darkness and into the kingdom of light. And so as Peter opens up this account of how we should relate to the state or to the government, he opens up with our identity, that we actually don't fundamentally belong to this world. Then he moves from what we are to what we do. He says to abstain from lusts which wage war against the soul. Lust, this is that word that we encountered earlier, right around chapter 1, verse 14. Epithumia. Epi meaning over or on, and thumia, desire. An over desire. So you might say, well, I'm not into any kind of lust or anything. This is anything that you are after, a desire which is inordinate. Do you know what I mean? Like if for some reason you really valued your girlfriend less than your goldfish, that would be an epithumia. You have an epithumia for your goldfish. If you were to put your job or your career over your family, that would be an epithumia. An over-desire, something that's inordinate. Like a career is okay and a goldfish is okay. Just don't love it more than your kids. Get my point? So he says here, you abstain, you get away from these epithumia, these over-desires, which wage war against the soul. That word is stratuo. Stratuo. You don't need to be a Greek scholar there to figure out what that means. Strategery. Strategic. Strategery isn't a word, by the way. Strategy. Wage war, that there's actually a war going on in your own soul. That when we engage in these kind of things, when we start to value things that God doesn't value, the way that we were designed is such that it actually wages war against us. We do damage to ourselves. How is it then that we're supposed to stand out as different in this world in which we live? Well, Peter continues, he says, live such good lives among your unbelieving neighbors that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. In what way are we supposed to be different in our world? Right here. Good lives, good deeds. Love. One word. Love. That's it. This is what true spirituality is all about. And this is assuming the fact that we're so close to other people that don't share our convictions that they can actually look at our lives and they can see good deeds. They can see something that's good, that's wholesome, something worth imitating, and good lives. Even as our culture is getting more and more into these dysfunctions and addictions and epithumia, inordinate desires, they can see something different by contrast. He says, so as a result, these unbelieving neighbors may glorify God on the day that he visits us. This means, to put it simply, that they come to faith, to glorify God. Why would these unbelieving people be glorifying God here on the day of judgment unless they had seen what happened with these Christians and they switched over from what their former beliefs were over into a belief in Christ. This is the way that that expression is consistently used in the New Testament. Yeah, why would they be glorifying God as they're being judged? Like, God, you're glorified as you're being judged. That just doesn't make any sense. No, this is they've changed. Why? Because of the good lives and the good deeds, they can see something different. How is it that they can notice fundamentally flawed people like me or you and see that a change has occurred? What do they mark that up to? There must be something external. There must be something supernatural happening here. Well, as I said, this is the gateway, the doorway into which he's going to address the subject of the state and spirituality. He says in verse 13, he says, submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do what is right. Submit to government. Yes, we need to submit to the government. There's no way around this. However, we should make some qualifications here. For one, this submission is not absolute. That is to say that this is not unqualified. Or to put that a different way, it is qualified. So we can read about the apostles in Acts chapter 5 where they go out and they're sharing about their faith in Jesus Christ, and the authorities, the government, shows up and says, stop. Stop doing what you're doing. So on the one hand, you've got the government saying you can't share about Jesus, and then you got Jesus saying you should share about Jesus, and they conclude in Acts 5:29, we must obey God rather than men. And this is something that we see consistently through our Bible, that whenever the Bible speaks of submission, it is never unqualified unless it is referring to God. He is the only one in whom we should, in an unqualified way, submit to his leadership. So too, even in the text itself, to submit yourself for the Lord's sake. Are we really to believe that God would want us to do something immoral because the government has told us to do that for his sake? Like, you know, if we were living in Germany in the 40s and, you know, the government was saying, go and kill Jewish people. Well, I'm just supposed to submit to the government. I guess that's what I need to do. For the Lord's sake, God says, thou shalt not murder. You should not kill. So, no, that just can't be the case. So this is not absolute. This is certainly qualified even within the text itself. Second, there is a subtle, subversive message in this passage. Do you see it? You see it right here. Every human institution. Or, literally, in the Greek, this is every human creature. Now, I know, if you were to read Josephus or Plutarch, they use this to refer to cities and to settlements and so forth, where, yeah, it refers to institutions. It's not referring just to creatures. We're not supposed to submit ourselves to every person. But, why does he have to throw in that part? I mean, this could be translated every human created institution, every created institution, something to that effect. Why does he just have to slip in that part about creation? Do you see what he's getting at here? He's saying, in effect, what we have here is that these institutions are creations. They are not the creator. This is in a world in which the emperor was venerated. He was worshipped as a deity. And God is saying here, no, that's not God. I'm God. They're just creations. And you're submitting to something which itself is a creature. Third, submitting, in many ways, we think, is a passive thing that we're doing. This isn't passive. This is a heroic stand of strength. To stand there and to say, I am going to willingly, freely choose to submit, even though everything in my body is telling me I don't want to do that. That is a heroic stance of faith. Let me put it this way. Which would be easier, to submit yourself to a perfect moral leader or to submit yourself to a fallen and fractured moral leader? To serve a leader like that, it'd be way harder to do that. Come on, it's totally harder. And so this isn't something that we passively do in some kind of a cowardly way. It's not weakness. This is strength. This is moving in love to help out and to get involved in fallen systems. Finally, what's the alternative to submission? In this period of history, if one was to rebel against the emperor, there would be only one alternative. That is death. You would be completely quelled by the Roman Empire. I mean, they would just completely wipe you out. You might say, well, how do you know that? That's just hypothetical. No. Peter wrote this in about AD 62, in AD 66 to 70. Just 5 years after this letter was written. I mean, the ink was wet on the parchment at this point. The zealot party in Israel caused a revolt against the Roman Empire. And this resulted in 1.1 million Jews being killed and 200,000 being enslaved. So you might say, well, if I lived under a tyrant, I wouldn't want to submit. Well, you don't have to submit. You could also just be killed or enslaved. That's the alternative. Now, in our culture, it's so funny, we're offended by this, and we live under one of the most, I know you're gonna cringe at this, but if you're a student of history, let me say this. One of the most non-tyrannical, loving, peaceful governments that's ever existed. And all of us Americans are like, I hate submission, submission or die, And throughout the wet rest of human history, people have lived under true tyranny, oligarchies, despots, evil, wicked, power-hungry people. And we live in a fallen government, too. We live under fallen leadership as well. And things aren't perfect here either. But, how dare we sit here and say, I just couldn't submit to the government. When Peter himself was not naive, he saw his rabbi, Jesus, murdered under a vicious government. Within a few years, according to 1 Clement 5, he himself was killed. By whom? By the Romans. He was crucified. So he lived out this ethic to the bitter end. He continues, he says, for such is the will of God, that by doing right, you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. So in the first century and the subsequent centuries, Christians were viewed with intense suspicion. According to Athenagoras of Athens, he was a late second century Christian philosopher. He said the Christians were viewed with suspicion and were pejoratively or negatively called atheists, incestuous, and cannibals. You say, what on earth? How did they even come up with that? Makes a lot of sense. In the Greco-Roman pantheon, they would say, so you're a Christian? Yeah, well, I'm a Roman. So what do you believe? Well, I believe in one infinite, personal, immaterial, all-powerful, omniscient, omnibenevolent, immutable God. What do you believe it in? Jupiter, Zeus, Apollos, Diana. I mean, we got statues. You can see the whole pantheon right here. Where's your God? Well, we don't have a statue. We're not supposed to make graven images. Well, will you worship Zeus? No, he's not God. Will you worship Diana? No, she's not God. Sorry. Hercules? No, definitely not God. Like, that's even half a God. Like, not even close to a God. So they would say, so you're an atheist. Theos. Don't believe in God. You don't believe in the gods. And so, consequently, they called Christians atheists. They said, you're guilty of incest. Why? Because they'd always marry a brother or sister in Christ. How about that? This is my sister here. And they would go, ugh, gross. They were cannibals because they would eat the Lord's Supper. This is my body. This is my blood. They thought it was the literal body and blood of Jesus. And so they were confused. We have reports of Pliny the Younger in the second century. He said, yeah, they were eating food, but it was of an innocent and ordinary kind. He thought that they were actually eating human flesh. So too, they were blamed for social disorder and disaster. When there was a famine, a flood, anything like that, when there was a drought, when there was war, when something went bad in the natural, or there was a tear in the social fabric of society, what was that the result of in a Greco-Roman mindset? Well, it was the result of not placating and worshiping and pacifying the deities enough. So we need to, you know, whip up some more sacrifices for Zeus or for Hera. We need to make them feel better. And then the drought will go away. And then the flood will go away. And then the crops will grow again. Well, in such a society, if you looked around and you're like, we're doing all the sacrifices, but there's this one group of people, the atheists, the cannibals, the sister lovers. They don't do any sacrifices. They won't pinch the incense to the emperor. They won't do. And so consequently, anything that went bad in the culture, socially or any kind of disaster, was blamed on the Christians. So too, they were scapegoats, very easy targets. I won't get into this at length, but Nero lit a fire, burned 10 out of the 14 quarters in Rome to build a big palace for himself. And consequently, according to Suetonius, he did this so that he could build this big palace. And he blamed it on who? Who would be the best group? The Christians. And so with all this and more, for such is the will of God, that by doing right, by doing good works, you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. What is the best press for Christianity? Good works. Why would people even listen to what we have to say unless they can see there's something good, there's something loving about these people? We've had this all over the city. We've seen one time and time again, over and over, where we moved into the inner city and we were met with fierce suspicion. Then we started to bring volunteer after volunteer. We won the presidential award, the 1,000 points of light for this ministry in South Linden. And all of a sudden, you know, people down there were very suspicious until they started to see the change in people's lives. The kids were getting educated. Kids who had never experienced love. 91% of the kids down there, single parent, no dad. 91%. And we have a ministry down there. Across the city, we have this. And people one time and again have seen they're doing good. We might not agree with what these Christians believe, but we can see the good that they're doing for the society. And so Peter says, act as free men. Do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as servants of God. Yes. So he's saying, you've got a choice here. You have the freedom to choose. The question is, what will you choose? Will you choose to live as free men? That's who you are. But will you use your freedom as an act of service and love of others? Well, that was then. We're doing a grammatical, historical interpretation. So looking at the grammar, trying to make sure we got the language right. And we want to know the historical backdrop against which this was written. That's why we're doing the history. But what about for today? Like, how does this apply to us today? We don't live under, you know, a tyrant. We don't live under someone like Nero, who we could go into ad nauseum descriptions of what Emperor Nero is like. We live in a different cultural milieu. We live under a different governmental system. So how do we apply this today? In two ways. For one, this would preclude this idea of a Christian nation. This is something that we've seen in the last 40 years or so, has become very popular in the religious right. This is some kind of a phenomenon that has been a burgeoning movement that believes that the United States is God's nation. And there's different extremes, you know what I mean? Like there's, on the one extreme, it would be like God is really behind this nation in a unique covenantal way. And we need to get back to our Christian roots, and on it goes. And we are, you know, somehow united with God in such a way. Then there's just people who generally hold that we're sociologically Christian. Like many people in our nation are Christian. See, I would agree with that part. If you're saying we're a Christian nation, in that we have a certain percentage of people that are Christians, sure, we could talk about that. That former definition, though, I must object to that in the strongest of terms, that we are somehow a chosen nation, almost like Israel? Please, first of all, that's not biblical. What do we read here? The Christians, in verse 11, are called aliens and strangers. How about Jesus? Matthew 28, he says to go into all nations. We can read on passage after passage. Revelation 7, where it says that you're supposed to, they're going to see in heaven, you know, every tribe, tongue, people, nation from all over the globe. No, there is no Christian nation singular. There's the kingdom of God spreading across the world, across the globe, into every nation. It's not biblical. Second, it's not even historical. There's this whole idea of a Christian nation is a myth of the religious right. This has never existed. This is a myth. It's a lie. Mark Knoll, a Christian historian and academic, he says the United States was the first nation to omit explicitly, catch this, Christian symbolism, such as the cross from its flag and other early national symbols. Whoa, that is a conspicuous omission, wouldn't you say? The first one not to put something like a cross or a fish or whatever on their flag. How about this? President John Adams, in his Treaty of Tripoli, the end of the 18th century, yeah. This was a treaty with modern-day Libya, which was today as a Muslim nation. Same back then. He said in that treaty, quote, the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. So we could have pundits today saying that we are, you know, founded on the Christian religion. The guy who was there when it was founded says it wasn't. And we could roll out quote after quote. Now, were many of the founding fathers Christians? Yes. Others weren't. Thomas Jefferson, our good Christian founding father, a deist. He was a deist. Benjamin Franklin. Oh, man, a little Danny DeVito looking guy, you know. Libertine is the word, you know, where they go in and sexually promiscuous. He would get into orgies over in France. Not a believer in God. He was a stonemason and everything else. Our good Christian founding fathers. This whole thing is a myth. Thirdly, it's not helpful. It is not helpful. The idea that we're some kind of a Christian nation. Think about it like this. Which really does the greater good? If we were to think about it like this, like this is our culture. Would it be better to reach the government at the top? And if you could seize control of the government and you could legislate from the top down, then that would take over the country? Is that the method we see? First of all, we see nothing like that in the Bible. Nothing. Not a word in the New Testament on that. But practically speaking, is that even helpful? Or would it be better to reach the culture at the bottom? Kind of like what Jesus suggested, like to go and make disciples of all nations, like where it's just one person encountering another person, sharing the love and forgiveness of Jesus, making an impact on his or her life, and then one by one, you start to make an impact until the entire culture is reached that way. Oh my God, that's such a better plan. Way better than anything we've ever seen. We read from Chuck Colson. This was Richard Nixon's hatchet man. He worked for the Nixon administration under Watergate, went to prison for it, became a Christian, and then started a whole dynamic ministry. He says this. He says, today's misspent enthusiasm for political solutions to the moral problems of our culture arises from a distorted view of both politics and Christianity. They've got it wrong on both fronts. Now, Chuck Colson is anything but some kind of an extreme liberal, okay? Chuck Colson was a very conservative guy. If you read his stuff, listen to him talk. The late Chuck Colson, he's gone. But at the time, I mean, he's saying we've got it wrong both politically and spiritually here. He writes, it also ignores the consistent lesson of history that shows the laws are most often reformed as a result of powerful spiritual movements, not vice versa. Yes, the abolition of slavery, chattel slavery in the United States and in Europe and in Great Britain specifically. These were antedated. These were preceded by what? The first and second Great Awakenings in the United States. People were coming to Christ like crazy, and all of a sudden they could see, oh, these other people have value. They're precious to God. Oh, slavery. That's not just that we shouldn't do it. It's a sin before God. It's evil. And so I agree with Colson's point. It's a spiritual reformation. You know, we could dictate laws, but that wouldn't change hearts. But if you had hearts that were changed, Oh, that'd be different. He writes, I know of no case where a spiritual movement was achieved by passing laws. I don't know of one either. I can't think of one. Think of it like this. Whenever the church gets into bed with the state, there's either atrophy for Christianity or there's atrocity. Atrophy meaning, like, you know, if you get a cast on your leg and your muscle turns, you know, weak. Atrophy. The church just dies. Or there's atrocity. The church gets creepy, weird, power hungry. Look at this. A Pew study here. Now they're going all the way out to 2050. You might be like, did I fall into a coma or something? What happened here? They're projecting here. This is a projection. But look at this. Asia, Christianity on the rise. Latin America on the rise. Africa on the rise. Europe. Oh, Europe. Poor, poor Europe. Where the church and the state are in bed together. Where they have the state church. In order to identify as a citizen, you needed to be signed up and baptized to be in the state church. And this went on for centuries. And what do we see? When you try and force Christianity, people, it just turns completely flaccid, useless. The power of Christ is impotent at that point. And finally, this isn't feasible. This isn't feasible. I love people saying, we got to get our Christian nation back. Oh, really? Really? Let me ask you a question. Which Christian or which Christian denomination should interpret biblical law for our society? Oh, yeah. You talk to a Baptist, they say, well, Al Mohler, obviously, president of the Baptist. You talk to a Presbyterian, oh, Tim Keller, of course. You talk to a Roman Catholic, well, the Pope, you know, Eastern Orthodox, you know, any denomination, they say, oh, it's our guy who should interpret it. So we can't even agree amongst each other. Then we say, well, should we appeal to Old Testament law like the Reconstructionists do? There's a whole creepy form of Christianity that thinks that we should bring back Reconstructionist Old Testament law. So you should not touch the skin of a pig. I guess football's out. Keep the Sabbath. I mean, so where do we draw from? Okay, you say, well, no, just New Testament law. New Testament law. So we have to mandate confession. We have to mandate gentleness. We have to mandate love your, if you don't love your neighbor, you get a fine, you get a ticket. I hope I'm just making the foundation under your feet kind of shake a little bit and just realize this isn't as easy as it seems. Instead, Christian philosophers, with whom I would agree. I'll put it that way. I need to speak for myself here. With whom I would agree. They would say that we need to appeal to natural law. Natural law is that we basically start with basic moral premises. That human life has an intrinsic worth or value. Justice, fairness, basic moral premises. And from those moral premises, you can make ethical arguments, and even legislation, public policy, and you start there. But if you go into the public arena with your Bible saying, you know, this and that, you're saying, well, it's because of my revelation. What about the Muslims? What about the Mormons? What about the Jehovah's Witnesses? What about any other faith? Well, whose revelation are we going to use? God's, that's who? That you can see that's completely prejudicial. When people that don't even believe in the Bible, we're going to use that as an authority. Instead, Christian philosophers would say we need to appeal to natural law. Is this going to give us a perfect society? No. No. We live in a fallen world. Where have you been? But this will mitigate evil. You know, things like egregious evil, murder, sexual assault, you know, damage of kids, stuff like that. We can basically argue from these moral premises very, very good legislation on that basis. Second, this would include political involvement. See, in Peter's day, submitting meant that we're trying to stay undercover. Because the alternative is what? The alternative is persecution. In our system today, we are actually encouraged by our government to participate in the political process. And so, consequently, it wouldn't be Christian to say, well, I'm just going to submit to whatever happens around here because the government is saying, vote. Get out to vote. Get out and do something. Participate in this process. So, it would be incumbent on us to get out there and play some kind of a role in our situation, in our time. So, you would say, well, that's not submitting. No, it is submitting to what the government is actually telling us to do, which is to play a role. How much should we be a part of this whole system here of getting into politics? I would just say that we should be very careful here. Very careful. Politics is not our priority as Christians. This isn't the thing in which we hope. We don't trust in human beings. We trust in God. Paul says this. He says in 1 Corinthians 9, I do all things for the sake of the gospel, not all things for the sake of my political party. That is so sick and twisted and perverted when people are more involved with politics. I'm talking about Christians here, okay? So if you're not a Christian here with us, you can feel very good about yourself. But for the rest of you, I want you to feel bad. He says, we'll do all things for the sake of the gospel. And that was true. I mean, Paul talked to many politicians, the Roman governor Felix, the Roman governor Festus, King Herod Agrippa II, and even the emperor himself. You know what he never talked about with any of those guys? Politics. That's a conspicuous omission. Instead, he just kept talking about this incredible message of love and forgiveness from Jesus, to the point where they were saying, Paul, in a little while, you're going to persuade me to become a Christian. Yeah, Paul just shared with anybody out there. And maybe you've never heard about that message of forgiveness that we've been talking about here. You should ask somebody about that, this free gift of forgiveness. It could be the case that you've never heard about it because there's been so much noise in Christianity, particularly in the West, where everything has become, you know, we're not even sure if we're a religion or if we're a political party. And this has become so confusing that this has become basically a stumbling block for people. So it should not be our priority. No. Moreover, we should approach this in the same way that porcupines have sex. Very carefully. Public policy. I love everyone getting up there with their attitude. Public policy. Oh, I know what would be best for this is if we did that and the other thing. And I'm like, really? Why do you think that? Why isn't it just obvious that if we did this one? Let me give you an example. Can I give you an example? LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, back in the 60s, he was a good Texas Christian man. And he put through legislation that would help single mothers who are having kids out of wedlock. Because the Bible teaches, you know, care for the orphans and widows, and this was the right thing to do, was to help these, you know, single moms. And so he gave a lot of legislation to help single moms. Now, that was in the 60s. So now we're 60 years later, and we've actually seen in these same areas that are seeing the most money being given to them, more poverty than ever. A bigger disparity in poverty between the rich and the poor. Whoa. Now, I've told that to numerous people, and they said, oh, so you're a Republican, huh? And then I've talked to other people, and they said, oh, so you're saying that because you're a Democrat, aren't you? Aren't you? No, I'm saying that to mess with you. I'm saying that to mess with you. Progressives would say, well, see, there's many other factors than just giving handouts. And that's encouraging breaking up the family unit. There's no women out there who are saying, I'm just going to have sex and have a ton of kids so I can make a bunch of money. What women are doing that in the inner city? Tell me, you know. And conservatives will come back and say, no, you're ripping apart the fabric of the family, which has an ability to keep money, intergenerational wealth together. And again, people hear that and they're just like, oh, so you're a conservative. You're a progressive. No. I'm just saying this to mess with you. Because people say, oh, it's so clear. It's the Christian thing to do, to give money to the single mom who's poor. Or, no, we shouldn't encourage that because a hard case makes a bad policy. Here's my point. My point is I've never studied public policy. I don't have a clue. I'm fairly ignorant about this. I don't know the ramifications. And I think getting out there, giving my opinion, like if we were to sit down and have a beer, maybe I'd give you my opinion, but I would never want to speak as though it's like a word from God or something like that. Humility is in order here. That's what we're saying. We often agree between conservatives and progressives on the what. Like, you don't have progressives and conservatives saying, we hate the poor. You know, we love killing people. You know, they're disagreeing rather on the how. How do we help the poor? Here's the way that C.S. Lewis puts it. He says, theology teaches us what ends are desirable and what means are lawful, while politics teaches what means are effective. If we have these qualifications, we may, of course, state our opinions, but then we must make it quite clear that we are giving our personal judgment and have no command from the Lord. Not many pastors have these qualifications. Most political sermons teach the congregation nothing except what the newspapers out in the rectory are saying. Yeah. The pastor doesn't know anything more about this public policy and political science than the person in the pew speaking for God. And they're just regurgitating whatever they've heard on the news, right? Whatever they've read. And so, yeah, I've got my own opinions and stuff, but I would never want to use this forum as an outlet to tell you who to vote for, political issues, and this just is not, that would be fully inappropriate to do. Speaking to ethics, speaking to spirituality, the Bible, that's different. I will say this to kind of mess with you a little bit more. We should be progressive on the right things, and we should be conservative on the right things. If you consider yourself a progressive, I hope to God in 1860 you would have been progressive with regard to slavery. In our culture today, moral norms are moving at such a lightning speed that we need to figure out which areas should we be conservative and conserve in those areas. As Christians, we're going to hold a different ethic on that. So I don't feel comfortable even saying I'm a progressive, I'm a conservative, because it's a category error. It's basically saying I'm assigning with just progressing, I'm assigning with conserving. We should know which is which and which is good, and we get that from the Bible. How we extrapolate that into culture, that's a different story. We should dialogue and discuss, finally, without falling prey to contempt. Oh, yeah, political polarization. Unless you've been living on the moon with your fingers in your ears for the last 8 years. Oh, boy, this has gotten real bad. People who have a, quote, very unfavorable view of members of the opposite political party. In 2016, 56%. And I know I'm a little older than you, and so you're like, you know, this is the way it's always been, man. No, it has not. It has not always been this way. That's threefold what it was in 1994. People were not this way. What about this? People who stopped talking to a family member or close friend because of the 2016 election. 1 in 6 Americans. What about this? People who would be displeased if their child married someone from the opposite political party. In 1960, it was 5%. Today, it is 40%. Eightfold. They would hate that if you married a Democrat, you married a Republican. Ugh. How about polarization in the House of Representatives, that's part of Congress, since the Civil War? Let's look at this here together. Republicans and Democrats, this is in 1879. This is Reconstruction, right? That's 1870s. This is just after they were, you know, spearing each other, North and South, musket balls, ripping each other, brother against brother, and, you know, a civil war. We're killing it. 15 years later, this is where the Republicans and Democrats were, voting in the House of Representatives. Today, we are even further apart than back then. This is getting worse. And if you're feeling that tug where, you know, people are getting worse on this, they are. This isn't just the media. The media are fueling it, for sure. But the media are not responsible for this. We are responsible for this. Here's a little hope, though. People who are exhausted from how politically divided our culture is. This is what people who study this call the exhausted majority. 93%. People are sick and tired of the political pundits. They're sick and tired of the Twitter battles, the ideological silos, the echo chambers. They're sick of it, and they're looking for hope. They're looking for love. They're looking for something else. And here we are. We're sitting on it. So Peter concludes, what's the solution? To honor all people. Honor is this word, tamao. It means to confer, quote, a price, an estimate, or a value on how many people? All people. Because every single person with whom you interact is made in the image of God. Every single person has incomparable value, unspeakable worth, incredible dignity. To hold a person in contempt, hatred, because of their political views. Honor all people, even if we disagree, even if they're on the other side of the fence on this. Doesn't matter. They're still made in the image of God. They're still a person for whom Jesus Christ gave his life. He says, love the brotherhood. So the replacement here is even during times of persecution, even under an unjust government, we still have each other. The warmth of relationships, as Peter put it in chapter 1, verse 22, to fervently love each other from the heart so we can draw close to each other. And then he concludes, fear God, honor the king. Isn't that interesting? Honor all people, honor the king. The king gets the same honor as anybody else. Why? Because he's a creature. He's just a human. You don't fear humans. In chapter 3, verse 14, he says, do not fear their intimidation. You don't fear humans. You fear God. To stand in reverence and awe of God. He says, but the emperor, no, he's just a guy. He's a dude. Subversive, very subversive. Let's wrap up with some questions here. As we traverse and enter into an increasingly polarized and separated culture, ask yourself, can I listen to and dialogue with and understand people with whom I disagree? Do I listen to people? I'm not talking about the shock jocks and all those. I'm talking about your neighbor, your people in your classes, your coworkers. Are you able to actually hear them, what they're saying? Or are you just pouncing on the first word that you disagree with? Trying to seek for understanding. Again, we often agree on the what rather than the how. Do I prejudge other people based on their politics? How about the guy? He said, who did you vote for in 2016? And the guy is one of our home church leaders here, and he said, I voted for so-and-so. And the guy said, I just cannot respect your leadership. Idiot. You're kidding me? You're kidding me? You're putting politics over God. That's what you're doing. Can't you see that? Here's a brother for whom Christ died. I can't trust him. Because of something he did on a Tuesday, and because he was following his own convictions. Oh, you're a real Harvard public analyst, aren't you? Huh? Oh, you know it all, don't you? Prejudging people before I've even gotten to know them, before I've even met them and know the content of their character. This is the new great divide here. What excuses do you give to justify contempt for people that are on the other side of the aisle with regard to their views? What excuse do you give? There's no hating people. There's no contempt for people. Again, I'm speaking to Christians here. Jesus Christ didn't have this view. Jesus Christ died for those who hated him, for those who had contempt for him. He did not justify contempt. Finally, do I share my political views more than I share about the love of Christ? Chattering away about, politics and this and that and the other thing. If you're a Christian here, is this the thing in which you place your hope? Well, I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case, that you're having a very difficult time in life, because the political landscape is very shaky, very turbulent. Oh, I'm so thankful I don't have to live through this, placing my hope in a government, placing my hope in a political party, a president, a Senate. I can't imagine what that would be like. That'd be awful. To wake up in the morning thinking, this is the place I'm going to trust. So thankful that I have the unchanging truth of Jesus Christ. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And he promised he's coming back. He's going to make all things new, restored. And we can look forward to that with anticipation.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.